Lima, Coast to Coast, number 16, November 20th, 2005. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to another show of Thelema Coast to Coast, the podcast dedicated to the exploration of Thelema, Aleister Crowley, ceremonial magic, and the occult. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of these shows. On today's show, we have an interview with Keith 418, talking about values, with Mike Conlon, former acquisitions editor for Red Wheel Wiser. He's going to be talking about the realities of the metaphysical book business. And then our closing song will be from an OTO brother in Las Vegas who raps about Thelema. Before we get into those, I have a few things to discuss. First, I want to thank Brent in Eureka Springs, Arizona, and Bob in Cornwall, England, for their newest postcards. They are up on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. In particular, Bob's postcard is from an artist named Barrington Colby, and if I am correct, that's the same artist who did the illustrations for Led Zeppelin's album, Led Zeppelin 4. I've received some feedback from a few listeners who say they don't hear enough of me. As far as I'm concerned, the show is mostly about the listeners and the guests that are on it. The less you hear of me, the better it is, I think. However, if you really do want to hear what I think on things, you can go and listen to a few interviews of me on other podcasts. Recently, I just did one about a 20-minute interview about Will in Thelema on a podcast called Dio's Shadow. And that is Dio Shadows number 5. There'll be a link in the show notes. And also in the past, I did an interview on the Wicked podcast where we talked about 30 or 40 minutes. So go check those shows out if you want to hear my thoughts on Thelema. The links are also on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Speaking of, there are four ways to contact me and the show. First is the Thelema Coast to Coast website, www.thelemacoast2coast.com. The email is podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. Those who want to leave a voicemail message, and I really, really encourage this, call 206-20-AGAPE or 206-202-4273 and leave a message. And finally, there is the old-fashioned snail mail, and you can write to me at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, C-R-O-W, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A-G-A, 30065, and that's in the U.S. of A. One of the things that I was very committed to in the beginning of this podcast is not asking for money or payment. And all of the sponsors who I mentioned on the show are not actually sponsoring with money, so I get no benefit of it. All the sponsorship that you see is from like Grass Games, who's going to be giving some games to listeners, or Magus Books, who does recommendations and gives listeners information about books. I receive no payment. However, listeners who do want to give something back to the podcast can link to the podcast website on their blog or on their website, send feedback, or send postcards, or just get the word out about the podcast. So far, we have about 1,000 or so listeners a podcast, and I would love for that to go much, much higher. Speaking of our sponsor, Grass Games, at the end of November, I will be giving away a full suite of their games. to one lucky registrant on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. So if you haven't already done so, please go to the website and register, and one listener will be randomly chosen from the registrants and given the registration codes to activate all of the games. Now, Grass Games makes a number of arcade-type games, and they are available for both PC and Mac OS X. Anyway, that's enough of me going on about things, so let's get into the interview with Keith 418 on values.
We have Keith 418 on the line. 93, Keith.
93, John. Thanks for having me.
Recently on your blog, you did a series of posts about values and how values are determined by metaphysics.
Uh-huh.
Can you explain why values matter? I know we've talked about it on previous shows, but just kind of give a more focused discussion on values themselves.
Sure. Well, I think values are really interesting, and I think value philosophy itself is something really interesting, and it's something that people talk about a lot. I don't really know how much thought they give to the origins of it. Martin Heidegger points out that value philosophy really started as a reaction to the nihilism of the 19th century, where people realized that the previous metaphysical beliefs that they had about God and the nature of creation and reality sort of didn't work anymore. And as Heidegger points out, with the dissemination of Nietzsche's teaching, value philosophy, value discussion, values as sort of a response to the total value-free instrument that science was and the world that it presented became more important. And opposed to valueless science, which, you know, science doesn't really tell us what's good or bad. It just is. I mean, you can get up in the morning as a scientist and go to work to cure a disease and get up in the morning and go to work and come up with a way to kill a million people with a nuclear weapon. And science is going to serve you in both ways. Science isn't sitting over you saying, well, it's good to work on this disease cure and it's bad to work on this nuclear weapon. Science will go to work for you regardless of what you want to do. So science doesn't really have a strict sense of moral values. In fact, Nietzsche points out that science is bad for values. It sort of undermines and critiques any kind of value that you're going to come up with. People in the 19th century looked at this and said, well, what are we going to do about it? And opposed to that sphere of value-free science, people came up with a sphere of values and said, okay, well, even though science is value-free in a lot of ways, we're going to come up with this other kind of value discussion and sort of posit it. And one of the things that Carl Schmitt points out in his essay from the late 50s and early 60s on the tyranny of values is that values don't exist by themselves. They only exist as part of judgments. So when you make a value judgment or a decision or you enact a value, the value comes to life in the process of you doing something, of making a judgment, of making a choice. The values don't just sort of hover around there free of any life. And so values are seeking, as he puts it, to materialize. If you have strong values, you want to see those values actually materialize and come into being around you. You want your judgments to be informed by those values. And this is something I think people need to realize as magicians. I mean, we are working to materialize our goals and our aims and our will. And I think oftentimes people don't sort of understand that the value judgments they make are informed by a metaphysical system of right and wrong, of good and evil, of positives and negatives, and we need to see what is really informing the values that we have and the way they come into being and materialize as we make value judgments and decisions. So oftentimes, you know, people will say, well, when someone does something they don't like, well, you're making a value judgment. Well, people make value judgments all the time. I mean, I don't think you can go too long throughout the day without making a value judgment of one kind or another. And I think that the Thelema community in particular has some problems regarding this because, on the one hand, people want to see themselves as being relativists and sort of subjective and, oh, you know, there isn't any one true reality. Everyone has to kind of make up their own. And on the other hand, they're made uneasy by the fact that if all of us as individuals are putting our own values into effect, there's going to be conflict. And this is another thing that Carl Schmitt points out, and I think very perceptive, especially for us, is that everyone coming up with their own values and putting into effect is basically a sort of scenario for war. And the point of your individuality, your subjective point that makes the value judgment and puts it into effect and makes the decision is an attack point. this is what Max Weber called the seamy underside of values. And people in the Thelemic community have a sort of, I think, have a very strange idea about how this is supposed to work. They picture this neutrality where, you know, everyone is free to have their own values, but as soon as the value actually comes into being, they start conflicting with one another. And that's the point that everybody has a problem with. So if you want to look at why we don't have any goals, why the OTO doesn't have any strategic goals, why it doesn't hold people accountable, why it has problems making consistent value judgments, the answer is it seems to want to preserve and conserve a neutrality where, you know, nothing really happens that's significant. There isn't any serious place for these values to come into being and start fighting with each other. And in fact, you know, you can see that most of the divisions in the community are caused by strong-willed individuals with differing values seeking to enact those values and coming into conflict. So I think this is something that, you know, we need to look at.
Well, this brings us back to some of the original things that we talked about. The only way I could see getting beyond the value conflict is not to try and change someone's values per se, but to give them something to be working on in combination, like some strategic goals or something.
You're only going to want to work on those strategic goals if they meet your values. And you're only going to want to evaluate whether those goals are working or not, or whether they're making good progress or not, if the goals fit your values. If they don't fit your values, you either won't care whether the goal gets, you know, done or not, or you will work against it. So if you have a bunch of people, for example, whose values are, you know, we have the right to party all the time and not do anything, and the OTO comes in and says, well, we want you to do X, Y, and Z, and we want accountability, and we want a schedule, and we want you to be accountable to us about how you accomplish these things, then there's going to be a conflict there, because the people who have the value of you can't boss us around and we can have a party are going to have a conflict with the people who say, yes, we can boss you around and here's the things we want you to do. And on the one hand, you have people in the OTO who really want the organization to improve, but at the same time, they don't want to have a conflict with people who have different values than they do. Now, that's kind of stupid, but that sort of stupidity is what I think a lot of the leaders are suffering from. So how does that get resolved? I don't know.
I think at some point that's where maybe leaders need to step in and say, you either play it this way or, you know, goodbye.
Well, they'll do that if they feel like they have sufficient support, or if they feel the situation is grave enough. The problem is that it's almost like a Gulliver and the Lilliputians. They're tied down by these tiny things. They're dying the death of a thousand cuts. There's a difficulty where it's not one big crisis that sort of pushes them into this position, but it's the little things that they let go and let slide that, you know, generally create a less than challenging, less than adult, less than serious atmosphere. And that's the sort of crisis that they're in. I mean, I had, you know, one person in the OTO say to me recently, how do we fix a situation without imposing our own ideas on it?
You can't.
Now, I think you're right. I think most adults would see that kind of statement as being completely absurd to begin with. I mean, why are you the leader if you're afraid to impose your own values on a situation? But again, we want to have everybody free to construct and to enact their own values. And at the same time, we don't want those values to be in conflict with each other. And we don't want people fighting as they try to enact their values. So what seems harmonious and wonderfully neutral of everybody having the right to do their own thing and have their own values suddenly becomes a violent battle of all against all when those values start to get enacted, when people take the values seriously. And again, you know, I think you and I both have come to the conclusion that if the OTO took itself seriously and started having serious goals and acted like a serious adult organization, that there would be a lot of conflict, because a lot of the people would rebel against that and say this is not what we want, and there would be a lot of fighting and a lot of problems. But that only would occur if everyone gets the idea that the OTO can be all things to all people, and whatever your values, you're welcome here and, you know, have fun.
See, I honestly think that if the OTO got serious and the leaders took the OTO seriously and made goals and made metrics and all of those things we've talked about before, it would have a certain level of attrition from some of the members that are in it now. But I think it would end up being a lot more attractive to a larger group of people, and the order would actually grow.
Well, whether it would grow or not, it might attract people that were really serious and were expecting a serious environment. I mean, on the one hand, that people are very concerned about alienating the folks they have now, but they're not at all concerned about alienating the folks that they have who are alienated by a values and strategic goal-free environment, and who, you know, the potential people out there who are expecting us to be serious and are disappointed when they show up and see that it's really a sort of failed attempt to have this kind of hippie commune thing from the 60s where everybody's free to do whatever they want and there's no value judgments being made. Saying there are no value judgments allowed is itself a value judgment. I mean, there's no way around that. And unfortunately, you know, this is a problem that the order faces. What I think is encouraging and what I think is a good thing is that more and more people are looking at this and going, and some of them are the listeners on this podcast, they're looking at the situation going, this is totally absurd. I mean, there's a very healthy kind of skepticism and a very healthy kind of growing critique that just reveals that this is completely untenable. And I think that's really positive. I mean, I think that's a very positive step, that people are beginning to wake up and go, hey, this is just silliness. This is not a serious group. Serious people don't behave this way. Serious people don't have these kinds of lame expectations. And serious people don't get excited and slap each other on the back over things that everyone should be taking for granted.
Unfortunately, we have only a small segment of time today, but what we can do is continue this and next time we get together and talk. So
terrific.
thanks for being on this show again.
Well, thanks for having me, John. 93.
Mike Conlon was the acquisitions editor for 4 years at Red Wheel Wiser. Over that time, he got to understand the industry of occult publishing very, very well. And he gives us a bit of his insights and understanding about where the industry is at and where it's going in the future. So I hope everybody finds this interview interesting. It's a little different than the ones that we've had before, but I think is still very relevant, being that, one, we have a lot of book aficionados in the occult community, and two, I know a few people listening are would-be authors and would love the information on how to get out there and get their book known to people. So here's Mike Conlon, former acquisitions editor of Red Wheel Wiser.
We have on the program with us Mike Conlon, from our former acquiring editor of Red Wheel Wiser. Are you there, Mike?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast.
Thank you for having me on the show, John.
We have a lot of questions from listeners about publishing, but first, let's get into your background, how you got into publishing in general, a quick introduction to that, and then what you did with Wiser, and then with the purchase of Wiser by Red Wheel, what you did with Red Wheel Wiser.
Sure. My introduction to publishing was pretty fun. I answered an ad for an assistant editor in a local paper, and being freshly graduated from college with an English degree, I thought, you know, a hometown publisher that needs an assistant editor, I would be perfect for this. Didn't hear back for a long time. Finally got the phone call I was hoping for and was just completely blown away until they said that they wanted to hire me for their warehouse. In a moment of weakness, I agreed to work part-time for them. I was working full-time at a grocery store at the time and was able to work part-time and just kind of really liked it. You know, I'd always been into books, especially kind of the more esoteric end of things, and this was just kind of a perfect match. From there, I went to be assistant manager of the warehouse. I went over to the order department in the office proper, worked into production as a production worker. Production are the people that actually put the books on press. They'll take things from the editorial stage and act as an intermediary with a printer. I was production manager in the late 90s, and in 2001, the company was purchased. It used to be Samuel Wiser, run by Donald Wiser. And it was purchased by the new owners of the company, Michael Kerber and Jan Johnson, who renamed the company Red Wheel Wiser. I was production manager for them for a couple of years before they recognized kind of the company knowledge that I had and kind of the knowledge set that I brought to the job and decided to ask me to be acquiring editor. And that's what I've been doing the past 4 years, was acquiring manuscripts. So people would send manuscripts in, or agents would send manuscripts in. I'd be kind of the secondary screen for those, and I would be the one to bring books to the publisher for consideration for publishing. And after that, it would go to an acquisitions board. Recently, I was laid off. The editorial and production end of things is moving to California, and with a son out here, I'm not in a position to move, so it was time to part ways. So that's where I'm at right now.
One of the first questions, or actually this has been repeated a number of times by some of the submitted questions of listeners, is how does a person who has a manuscript submit it? What's the best way to do that? What's the best way to get it seen? Does having an agent help?
Having an agent at this level is only kind of sort of helpful. An agent can definitely give a writer direction as far as who they should be sending their work to, but a writer in the new age and occult field probably knows enough about the players in the field to be able to figure out where to send things anyway. The thing to check on is some companies have a submission policy where they will only take a manuscript that is submitted by an agent. But for the most part, as far as I know, most of the companies like Red Wheel Weiser, New Page, Llewellyn, Inner Traditions, all the main players in the field will take unsolicited manuscripts straight from an author. So whether or not you get an agent, the best thing to do is, and an agent can help you set up a submission. The submission is a little bit about the book, a little bit about the author, a whole lot about marketing, what the book is about, who it will appeal to, who's going to buy it, and kind of you're selling the book to a company as if you're selling it to pretty much the end user. You know, why are people going to want this book? There's some mechanics about it, and the specifics about it are kind of unique to each publisher, so either get online or write to them for their submissions guidelines, because there will be specifics about each individual one that might not work for the other. A good rule of thumb is a cover letter describing the briefly describing the project and the author yourself. Then follow that up by a more in-depth analysis of the book, why it is different than other books on the market. List the other books on the market and how yours is different from that. Include a table of contents and some writing samples. So if you don't have the whole manuscript done, at least have an introduction and a couple of chapters. That goes a long way. Some people submit only a proposal without any writing samples, and inevitably we write back saying, great, this sounds good, but unless you're a huge player, we're going to need to see some writing samples for a first-time author. The other way that people do it is they'll send in a complete manuscript. They'll have finished it, and we'll receive a short cover letter with a complete manuscript, and sometimes we buy on that. So it's really all over the place, but your best bet and the most receptive publishers are going to be to your work is if you follow their submission guidelines.
Now, is it better to submit hard copy or digital, emailing a PDF or a Word document?
It very much depends on the relationship you've established with the submissions person. If you're submitting blind, definitely submit a hard copy. Nobody likes to get attachments from people they don't know.
Right.
So that's a big no-no. I mean, unless you've already established yourself, you've sent an email of introduction saying, hey, I've got this book, can I send it to you in electronic format? And, you know, very often people will say no. Unless you've established that rapport with a publisher, then no, it's always better to submit a hard copy.
Okay. Now, one of the listeners says that Crowley once remarked on the nature of publishing magical texts, saying that they all suffer from a certain stigmata, an excessive difficulty in publishing them. Do you still think this holds true today? Do magical texts pose some inherent quality that makes them difficult to bring to the public?
There's kind of two answers to that. The first answer is, compared to what Crowley was up against, no, there is not that kind of a backing off or a wariness about occult material anymore. Most publishers, I mean, now, you know, Weiser is one of them, but there are specialty publishers who specialize in publishing occult material where there weren't as many, if any, back when Crowley was trying to publish things. So that has changed very much, kind of the proliferation of companies who will publish or at least consider esoteric subjects. So that's the first answer. The second answer is, okay, now you've got these companies that are willing to publish it. They're going to base their decision on the marketplace, who's going to buy it, and that's where you start running into trouble because people will buy occult works from authors they know. They're a lot less willing to take a chance on a complete newbie. So you've got a marketplace that is willing to accept occult material a lot more than in the past. I think the stigmata that Crowley is talking about is definitely gone, but it's been replaced by pure market dynamics, where if you don't get enough people buying a book, then a publisher will be less likely to take a chance on a similar book in the future.
One of the things that I've found is the marketplace is really poised to take a bunch of introduction books.
Mm-hmm.
There does not seem to be a lot of occult authors who assume a certain level of knowledge in the reader and go to a more intermediate or advanced type book. The other thing that I see a lot of is reprints of older material, and sometimes that's the best stuff that's out there. A lot of the new things coming out are for, you know, your general practitioner, another introduction to ceremonial magic, or mm-hmm. another introduction to Kabbalah or introduction to tarot. Why do you think there's such a lack of books that really get into a lot of substance?
I'm going to lay a lot. I mean, this is going to sound kind of harsh, but I'm going to lay a lot of the blame on the readership. They just don't sell. People say they want these advanced books, but then when we do an advanced book or we have an advanced book on our backlist, they languish. Maybe there are 1,000 people out there in the world that really want that book, and maybe that's going to be it. In the bigger scope of modern publishing, just doesn't cut it as far as a popular book goes, as far as a book that can actually make money for both the author and the publishing company. Going back a step further, that's kind of a common misperception that a lot of people have. They think that, New Age bookstores and esoteric publishers are out there providing a service for people. And in a sense, that's true. But in another sense, the grueling reality of it is that they're also a business. They have to stay in business, so they can't publish the things that perhaps they think are important or, think should be out in the marketplace because people are asking for them. And, a lot of that has to do with the move in the publishing industry, the bookselling industry, away from specialty stores, specialty independent stores, towards chain stores. Now the majority of sales are being pandered to the lowest common denominator. Not that intelligent people avoid chain stores, because they're kind of the only show in town in a lot of cases, especially smaller towns. Yeah, there's been a sea change from the mid-90s to now, where independent bookstores, the kind that cater to a clientele that would purchase those intermediate and advanced books, have all disappeared. There are a couple of notable exceptions, but they're the exceptions rather than the rule. So with that, kind of that shift in how books are being sold, it also is a shift in how books are being bought and what books are being published. So the market, for whatever reason, will always welcome a new introductory book, because that has worked in the past, historically, and it is an easy sell, whereas a more difficult book, an intermediate or an advanced-level book, there just doesn't seem to be the market there. Book buyers and people in general are a lot more reticent to buy those books.
How do you think the Internet is affecting all of this, especially with large players like Amazon.com?
The Internet is actually there's kind of two answers to that. One is that it's taking up the slack. In two ways. One is unofficially, people are getting more of that advanced knowledge in more intimate settings. It's not a book. It's not a book you'll take home and read. It's information you'll access on the Internet, and eventually groups that you'll kind of find out and be able to ask questions about. The whole alt magic scene, specialty groups on Yahoo and other forum type groups, I think are filling in that need for those advanced books. The other kind of revolution that's going on is kind of the self-publishing aspect of the Internet. If your book gets turned down by a publisher, you can turn around and for not too much money have that book published by somebody like iUniverse, Lightning Print, any number of other self-publishing sources where it's ridiculously low, like less than $200. You can get your book out there. It'll be on Amazon. It'll be in the Ingram system so bookstores can order it. And then it's up to you to market the book and find that audience. So, two things. The Internet is providing an alternative to those intermediate and advanced teachings that are no longer available in books, but it's also providing authors and groups that want to get their knowledge out there with another avenue to do so.
By the way, there's a company called Lulu.
Lulu, okay.
Their entry level cost, I think, is $20. So you can actually get your book out there for next to nothing. But the bigger question is, How is that direct to print functionality affecting book sales or book production? Is that another reason why the costs of production become much more important? Why soft covers are becoming more and more prevalent and hard covers are becoming less prevalent? What's happening with the book production, I mean the actual physical printing, that is pushing more and more books towards certain price points in soft cover versus hardcover?
I mean, a lot of that is publishing based on marketing. You know, you get it stuck in your head that, you know, certain page counts must be below certain dollar amounts to sell, you know. So, like, say we were putting out a 160-page book, I don't think I'd feel comfortable going over $14.95 on that. And then all of a sudden, once you've established a budget like that, then you're building the book to the budget, which can be a good thing as far as the marketing goes, but it can be a bad thing if it affects editorial decisions. The cost of print-on-demand books, which is what we're talking about when we talk about self-published micropress and kind of those services like Lulu you were talking about, those really don't have much bearing because the unit cost to print those books one at a time, which is exactly what the machine does, what the technology is, makes the unit cost very prohibitive. And it's a quandary for publishers. You know, they'd love to take advantage of the process, but if they have to pay a royalty on top of a high unit cost, you're going to see that same 160-page book selling for $22.95 or something. So it's going to have a very limited market. In general, though, and you know, getting back to Amazon, it's like this: when Wiser Books published General Principles of Astrology, it was remarkable how many were selling on Amazon versus how many were selling either direct to consumers through our order department or to bookstores, simply because of the discount. You know, people didn't want to pay $75 for a hardcover, and if they could get 10%, 20% off from Amazon, they jumped at that. So that's where the bulk of sales were. Wiser has another book called Structural Yoga Therapy, which is a $40-$45 hardcover, somewhere around there, and it's the same thing. The author has a yoga practice out in Colorado, and people buying the book for that course and for their own knowledge generally buy it off of Amazon because it is an expensive hardcover. So I think that people in general are getting away from wanting to pay for quality books, and as a result, you see publishers dumbing down production to meet that. If you go into a bookstore and look at any popular hardcover, say, you know, the latest Daniel Steele or Stephen King hardcover or even Harry Potter, if you whip the jacket off that and take a close look at it, I don't know if it's got headbands or not, but chances are the signatures are not sewn together. There won't be headbands. The board, the covering over the board, which was traditionally cloth or leather to make it last, is now paper, and you know, it's gotten away from what a hardcover was. In the same way, paperback technology has increased to the point where, I mean, they're much better than kind of the mass market paperbacks, the pulp stuff that people were used to back in the 50s and 60s, where you get yellowing within a year. You know, most of those are now printed on acid-free paper. So there's kind of been a meeting in the middle with the market dictating that, you know, people don't want to spend a lot for book knowledge anymore.
So it really is the mass consumer market that is driving a lot of the decisions. And so people who are doing collecting books of certain quality or a certain subject matter, there's less and less for them to collect for new books.
That's correct, but I mean, there is, you know, there is also becoming kind of this small niche publishers who understand that. Neptune Publishing did these two beautiful, very quality hardcovers, printed end papers, cloth jackets, very nice paper, outstanding design, and they were basically targeting specifically the Crowley and OTO crowd with those.
So you're getting kind of this bifurcated market where you've got the mass market paperbacks and low-quality hardcovers that are printed in large quantities.
Right.
And then you have on the other side the small-quantity hardcover, high-quality collectors that do, you know, 500 to 1,000.
Right.
What kind of quantities did Red Wheel Wiser put their books out, whether it be the paperbacks or the hardcovers?
Typically, I mean, it would all depend on the book, but something like, you know, Magic Book 4, Libre ABA, we probably reprint in the range of 2,000 every run. And that reprints fairly regularly. For General Principles of Astrology, I believe that first printing was 3,000. But that's the exception with those hardcovers. We've done other hardcovers that have a more mass market appeal, you know, which print upwards towards 5,000, and then you get something like the Wiser Classics that we do, let's see, The Lesser Key of Solomon by Joseph Peterson, where that was maybe 1,000 or 1,500 copies.
So it still is, I mean, compared to large markets where they're printing 10, 15, 20,
right,
50,000, they're still low quantities.
Oh, right. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. Ridwell Wiser is still considered small press, small to medium. You know, as large as it is in kind of the stature or whatever, you know, or whatever people's perceptions are, you know, compared to somebody like Chronicle Books or HarperCollins, we're still pretty much small press. So there are books that we do up print runs to 10, 12, 20,000. For the most part, the bulk of our books publish at around 5,000.
And is that the same for the soft covers?
Yes. I mean, I'm sorry, that is soft covers I'm talking about.
Okay. Hard covers are variable based on the actual hardcover unit itself.
Right, and I mean, we kind of dabbled in that. Like, there were some that we put out kind of limited edition hardcovers. Like, we did an edition of The Key of Solomon the King, the old Mathers text, and we did a run of 500 hardcovers with that. And very often things will migrate from hardcover into paperback. So, Grimoire of Armadale, Forever and a Day was hardcover. Then we finally switched that to paperback. So it's always a decision. I mean, the switch to paperback is very much based on sales. When hardcover sales slow down, we lower the price. We're able to get the information out there and do it kind of in a timely basis. It's not out of print for too long and at a more affordable price.
Well, let's talk about the print schedules, because I don't think a lot of people are aware. One of the things that I wanted to offer certain authors with Luxor Press is a quicker turnaround.
Right.
Because I don't think people are aware of the fact that once a manuscript is submitted by someone like Wiser,
right,
it could be as long as 18 months before the book actually comes out to market.
Right.
And one of the things that I was able to do with Luxor a number of times is cut that down to as much as 9 months, 9 to 12 months.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, that's you can get even more extreme. And you know, like when something big happens in the world, I'm trying to think of something.
Well, I remember the Star Report a number of years ago.
Oh, right, yeah.
That was turned around within a matter of a week and a half.
Right,
the paperbacks
right.
were in the bookstores.
Exactly.
I mean, in the general production, if somebody is submitting a manuscript and the company says, okay, we're going to accept this, they need to expect that it is going to be over a year in general before that book comes out.
Right, very much, and I'm glad you asked that, because there's a lot of misperception about that. I mean, somebody might think, okay, I've got my book done, it's ready to be published, here you go, I should expect books in, what, you know, 6 months, 5 months, tomorrow, and it's very unrealistic because of the way modern publishing works. Before it goes anywhere, it needs advanced marketing and publicity. And that starts with putting it in a catalog. So the process it goes by is a book is acquired, and that acquisitions process can actually be months long. Getting it in front of the right people, maybe running it by a reader who knows the field, and then into an acquisitions meeting. Offers are made, contracts are signed, at which point it's actually on one of our lists. And generally we'll give an author kind of a two-season general idea of when the book's coming out. So if I signed a book today, I would tell an author, you know, the earliest it's going to be is next fall. More realistically, it'll be next spring and or the following spring. And there's an outside chance it could even fall to 2 years from now. Generally, there is a 12 to 24 month period after a book is acquired before it's actually seen in print. And the reason that there is that delay is to try to make the book as successful as possible. So when we acquire a book, we plan it. It falls into a catalog season where it will show up in a catalog. Before that even happens, we're selling it to our sales reps. We're also selling it to the chain stores and distributors based on sales sheets with covers that we came up with, which might not be the final cover on the book. That's also a round of finding out what's working for a book as far as a cover goes. So there's an awful lot of work that goes on behind the scenes, marketing-wise, before a book can become a book. And then on the production end of things, yep, there is a 3 to 4 month schedule while the book is in production, from a manuscript through copy editing, typesetting, proofreading, and various iterations up until the end when it is published. There's also back and forth with the author during those phases. So when all is said and done, yeah, I mean, it takes, you know, 18 months is a good general rule of thumb, and it could be 6 months either side of that.
When you're looking at marketing, what are the various things that you consider in marketing when accepting a manuscript? Obviously, the author had to make a case that there's a need for this book, that this book addresses a subject or a particular niche that isn't covered.
Right.
But what other aspects do a publishing company look for from an author? Do they need to be able to travel and promote the book? Do they need to be able to do talk shows, radio shows? What kind of things does the publisher ask of the author to promote the book?
In the case of Red Wheel Wiser, we ask for, in order for a book to be successful, there needs to be a lot of author self-promotion, or at least an organization surrounding an author that can give that author support. You know, and I'm not talking about Thelema, OTO, anything like that. I'm just talking about generally. A lot of authors come in with a proposal that they've fleshed out after doing workshops and speeches and lecturing engagements and stuff like that. So they've kind of already got a built-in crowd that they can basically shill to. On the esoteric and occult end of things, you know, from Wiccans with their own coven and their own groups, their own gatherings, to magicians, you know, with like groups. You kind of depend on the author to spread the word that way. On the other end, the publishing company is good for general marketing. So when we're making marketing decisions, it figures into the acquisition a little bit, but you know, the effort that the author is going to put into it isn't the biggest decision by any means. It's more, who is this book going to appeal to? Who can we market this book to? You know, what is the market for this book? Is it, you know, 63-year-old archaeology students? You know, okay, that's a very limited market. That's not going to work for us. Is it, you know, kind of a younger crowd who is just getting into magic for the first time? Okay, well, there's a lot of them. So that would be a good market to market to. And it's very much targeting the market. Like, the worst thing an author could do is send in a proposal that says, this should work for everybody from, you know, 18 to 75, men and women from all walks of life. Well, that really doesn't do us a lot of good, and we'll have to go through it and find out who it really should be targeted to. So being upfront and honest about that is very much more to an author's advantage than trying to be as inclusive as possible.
A lot of the big chains charge for placement. Has Red Wheel Wiser ever paid for placement within any of the chain stores?
You know, that's more on the marketing and publicity side of things, so I'm not exactly sure about that. But I would guess yes. You know, just to be a player, you need to be out there. You need to have your books shown out there. You know, I think the lesson we realized over the past few years is that you have to be very selective with that, because one of the nasty secrets about publishing is this thing called returns. And unlike a lot of other businesses, publishing accepts returns from retailers. It's been kind of a traditional thing. It's something that all publishers growl about, because you know, you're never sure if a sale is a sale until you know, 3-5 months later, when those books start coming back. And in publishing, that can be as much recently as 20% of a print run, or 20% of initial orders, which makes things difficult. So on the chain store end of things, you pay for placement, but you might pay more dearly in the long run if those books don't sell and they start coming back to you. So general rule of thumb is you need to be selective with the books you're putting out there that you're paying money to display, and make sure that they're books that are going to sell in the general market. so that you actually make money on a book that you're spending that money on.
One of the other things that people are not aware of is the different models in which the wholesalers distribute books. For someone large like Red Wheel, they will probably take a large number of books and pay a portion up front. I can't imagine that Red Wheel is on consignment. But with companies like Baker & Taylor, Ingram, New Leaf, and some of the others out there, for the small publishers like myself at Luxor, my books are on consignment, which means I pay for the books,
right.
I pay for the printing, I pay for the shipping,
right.
They hold on to the books, and if the book sells, then I get paid 30 to 60 days after the book sells,
right.
And if it doesn't sell within a certain period of time, they send the books back to me, I have to pay for the shipping, and if the books get damaged any time during that process, I eat the loss.
Right.
So a lot of people are not aware of how costly it is on the backside for the logistics of transporting all of these books around. And towards what you're saying about the stores, the returns not only get returned if the books aren't selling, and I've talked to one large publisher out in the West Coast who does a very popular occult author that will do anywhere between 10 to 15,000 in a print run.
Yep.
And you know, and he comes out with a book that's he's printed 10,000. The chains will order, you know, 6,000 of them. He'll ship them all out. But then within 8 months, he's had half of those returned, and
sure.
So he really can take a bath on that. So I don't think people are aware of what's going on the backside. And then also, if people damage the books while they're in the bookstore, they will send that back, and the publishing company and the author will have to eat those costs.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a lot of hidden costs like that most book buyers just aren't aware about. I mean, you know, there's the consignment end of things, which you're talking about. And, you know, Redwood Wiser is no different. I mean, they do consignment to Ingram and New Leaf, as far as I know.
Okay.
So those sales aren't really sales. You know, they're books going out for some return at some point in the unknowable future. But yeah, returns are, they're a huge suck on costs. You know, it's kind of funny. They stopped it recently, but and I forget if it was Ingram or Barnes & Noble, and I don't want to demean either of them if it wasn't true in their case, but there was a time back when they were first coming into kind of being more widely accepted and being the avenue for the most sales, where they would buy books on 90-day terms. And then 90 days later, they would return any of those books that didn't sell while placing an order to replace those books.
Right.
So it was kind of this...
Actually, I have that exact problem with Baker & Taylor.
Right. I mean, it was kind of this this three-card Monty kind of shuffle that they were doing where, Wiser finally called them on and just said, you know, if this is the way you're going to do business, you know, we can't do business with you. And I think they heard it from a lot more people and a lot bigger people, because that practice stopped on with at least those two companies.
Now, one of the things that some people out there who are thinking about going into the small publishing business should be aware is that Amazon has a program they call Amazon Advantage,
mm-hmm.
in which before Amazon used to use the Baker & Taylor and the Ingram facilities to do all of their fulfillment. But they have since gone into their own fulfillment business, and they have a mechanism in which small publishers can send 2, 3, or 4 of each book,
right.
Depending on what Amazon wants, and they will actually store it in their Kentucky distribution center.
Yep.
And that way they can turn around books in 24 hours, and that's something that I participate in. I don't know if Red Wheel does. It probably is a different dynamic with the quantity that you're moving versus what Luxor moves.
It was, and I mean, I think it was about 2 years ago that we started, that Red Wheel started doing that, and I think at the time we were the smallest publisher that they had taken on in that capacity, where they took on the entire backlist. You know, no questions, no sorting through it and figuring out which are more saleable or not. They just blanket took on our entire backlist, and that was a real coup for us. And it has worked out. I mean, you know, Amazon is definitely a big player in the market now.
One of the stores that I work with frequently is Magus Books, and I have
right.
them as a sponsor of the podcast. Where do they kind of fit into this equation? You know, they're starting to disappear. I know all the ones in Atlanta, there used to be about half a dozen. Now it's down to 2, and one of them is only real interested in selling books.
Right.
Where do they fall into this mix?
We still, Red Wolf still considers them a very important part of the equation. There's Magus Books up in Minneapolis. There's still Bodhi Tree out in Los Angeles. Fields Bookstore up in San Francisco. What else? Seven Stars in Cambridge, along with Unicorn Books out in. They're still in Cambridge too. So there's, I mean, there are those stores out there, and we very much keep in one-on-one contact with them. Usually we've got a customer service rep that calls them directly and lets them know what's going on. We still outreach to all the independent stores with a newsletter that that I used to do. And, you know, more and more they're going to start becoming an outlet for those specialty books. The author that I was talking about earlier, Keith Richmond, he did The Magical Record of Frater Progrator and Progrator and the Beast, Frank Bennett and Aleister Crowley. Those are the two books that Neptune Books published. And it's an incredibly nice production, but you won't see them through normal distribution channels. You won't see them at Barnes & Noble. You won't see them at Borders. You'll only see them through limited distribution here, which kind of gets back into the whole kind of nut of occult publishing, you know, books that, quality books that are a little bit hard to track down.
Well, that also is for the Golden Horde books.
Right, Stephen Skinner's books, exactly. And I mean, that's something that, that Weiser jumped on. You don't see them in our catalog, but you will see them, in the newsletter, specifically being sold to independent bookstores. Kind of because that is becoming a very viable avenue for selling limited edition hardcovers like that.
One of our listeners asked about Weiser has been putting out various editions of the Equinox over the last few decades, going out back all the way to 71, 72. I think they put out a hardcover set.
Right.
What is the current plans with the upcoming Volume 1?
Well, the Equinox has a long history with us. It's, I mean, it's kind of an interesting book. And when I say book, I mean all 10 volumes of, or all 10 books of the first volume, Volume 1. You know, Crowley did it back in the early 1900s and basically went broke putting it out. And, yeah, I can understand why that happened, just because of the pure economics of it. The thing clocks in at close to 4,500 pages, which with normal book paper is a stack about 3 feet high. You know, if you look at the old white edition printed on the real heavy stock, that's an entire bookshelf of books. And
yes, I know, I have one.
Yeah, I mean, it's so for Weiser, it's always been kind of a mix. You know, do we go for the high production value? Do we just make it accessible? You know, at what price point are people going to be able to afford it? There's just so many variables there. You know, we've been kind of, Weiser has been kind of committed to keeping it in press through various iterations. The last one we did was the two-volume set, which, you know, the two-book set, which I don't think was the raging success we'd hoped for. But current plans are to continue with a 10-volume or a 10-book Volume 1 set. The 10 volumes will be, as far as I know, fairly identical to the first few reprints. The only thing that might disappear are the advertisements at the back of the books, but all the legitimate information is still going to be there. It's still going to be a facsimile reprint, which means that you know, nothing's going to be lost editorially. It'll still feature the additions that I forget who it was, but somebody in the OTO provided for the two-volume reprint. The reality of that is that it's a huge expense. I mean, it's I think we've planned on 1,000 or 1,500 copies, but I mean the print bill for that is just astronomical. So when you start looking at what you could be doing with that money rather than publishing the Equinox, it gets really difficult to justify it. You know, when you can do 6 new books for the same amount of money that it would cost you to do the 10-volume set to limited sales, then it gets really, really questionable.
So we got to get all our listeners to go out there and
absolutely call the Weiser order line, back order it on Amazon, do whatever you need to. But yeah, definitely get those orders in because that's really what talks.
okay.
You know, until you get people, until we hit enough. You know, ideally, we'd have enough back orders on hand to cover the print run. That probably won't happen, but a significant amount of back orders would definitely tip it toward actually doing it.
What percent of acceptance do you see? For every 100 manuscripts submitted, do you accept one? Two?
One or two, I would say. I mean, things go through an incredible screening process, so 100 might come in. Of those, you know, 70 would be screened out immediately. Of those 30 that hit my desk, you know, another 20 would go. Of those 10 that I brought to an editorial meeting, 5 might get cut. And then when I bring those 5 to an acquisitions meeting, you know, maybe 1 or 2 would make it.
And I also noticed that Red Wheel is doing a lot of historical reprints. One of the best books that's come out in the last few years is a reprint of The Canon. What is motivating Weiser to do that? No royalties? A desire in the market to have those books?
I mean, we also, we're also coming out with Opus Mago Kabbalisticum et Theosophicum by Georg von Welling, which is an old German text. And it's, you know, part of that is just remaining committed to keeping, to continuing to do those important works from the past, which either are overlooked or, you know, just have not seen a modern reprint. In that sense, when Donald Weiser was running Samuel Weiser, it was very much something that he kept his eye on, because running an antiquarian bookstore, you know, he was very much in the know as far as what people were asking for, what crazy prices people were paying for access to certain information that just wasn't available. So he could do books like that based on his knowledge, and for the most part we're continuing that. I mean, you know, I used to go over to the antiquarian bookstore up in York, Maine, and if any of your listeners are on the East Coast, that should be a mecca to head to every now and then. You know, I'd go through the books there and start asking questions. You know, okay, you know, is this book worth doing? What's this book? This looks cool, and just going through it like that. But basically, you know, we did it in the past. We're still doing it. And one of the lines that we distribute, Ibis Books, which is part of Nicholas Hayes, which is still owned by Donald Weiser, is starting to release a lot of classic old books in paperback editions, also some hardcover.
Now, what role does the Internet have? A lot of this reprint material is online. So you find that, how does that impact things?
It actually, I mean, you'd think that people would see it online and then say, why should I buy a book? But in actuality, we find it's just the opposite. People get interested in it online. They see the text, and all of a sudden it's a book they want to have. So they'll say, oh, great, you know, this book is in print. You know, I can buy a copy. This is perfect. So it actually helps out. I mean, technically, I think somewhere kicking around the Internet, there is a site with the entire Equinox, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there is.
Volume 1, and, you know, that hasn't slowed interest in the reprint that we're doing or sales of used books on the antiquarian side.
There's a lot of research being done into some of the past luminaries, including Crowley, of course, Akkad, Frank Bennett, you mentioned those books, and some of the other folks. Do you see more and more interest in those authors and their material and more reprints of their material in the future?
Not so much. I mean, I think, you know, just in general, you're stumbling into something that is kind of the guru end of things. You know, you've got a guru, which, you know, Crowley would probably never accept the title, but, you know, like it or not, that's kind of the model that he is as far as where he fits in into kind of a pantheon of people, you know, very much guru-based, a leader-based kind of thing. So you've got people like Gurdjieff, Madame Blavatsky, Crowley, you know, those people from back in the day who are always going to have a certain level of followers. They're always going to have people picking up on them and wanting to know more about them, especially their works. So that's not going to go away. What I think is going to be of less and less interest are the also-rans, the players that surrounded them. So like Bennett, you know, I know that Neptune Books published those books, but those are projects we passed on because we just didn't see the market for them. You've got to have a pretty big personality to make it in kind of that secondary market. So somebody like Lon Milo Duquette definitely does, because he's got kind of a fresh approach to the material, making it accessible and whatnot, where a more unknown player trying to do the same thing probably wouldn't have as much success.
So where do you see the market going in the next 10 years?
I don't know. I mean, you know, at Red Wheel Wiser, we were always looking for the next big thing, and sometimes we'd nail it, sometimes we wouldn't. One thing I think we're getting in early on is, and what you'll see in the next year or two, is Druidry popping up all over the place. You know, there was kind of, you know, a little catchphrase, you know, it might sound very derogatory, but it's actually just kind of a reality kind of thing, and you know, we'd go around saying, okay, Druidry is the next Wicca. Wicca was huge for a while, and then that kind of faded away. There's still a core audience for it, but for the most part, sales have dropped from that phenomenal surge. And, you know, Druidry is coming along as kind of the next thing. So that's look for that in the next couple of years.
What about other pagan trends like Asatru, runes, things like that?
Same kind of thing. I mean, Asatru, I don't think has the following, but runes remain popular. You know, some of our more popular books are Stephen Flowers' books, Futhark, Runemore, those types of books. So those are still strong and will remain strong and probably see an upsurge. We just did Taking Up the Runes by Diana Paxson, and that was a big breakout book.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Dealing with Crowley and Crowley's books is kind of fun because you start taking a look at some of the better-selling books like 777 and Book of Thoth, and you wonder, who are these books selling to? You know, you take a look at the books themselves, and they are completely esoteric. You know, anybody buying these books off the shelf thinking that they're going to have an easy read or some insight into magic or Crowley, you know, are usually, I have to think, sadly mistaken because, I mean, they're not beginner accessible books. So that's always fun to see, to wonder, you know, what those readers out there are getting out of that, if anything. You know, the book business is definitely in flux, is definitely trying to find out where things are heading, and the world is moving kind of on its own. I think you'll start to see, you know, the main publishers, like the bigger ones and the bigger smaller ones like Red Wheel, still publishing to their strengths, and you'll see a lot of upstarts start filling in the void that they've kind of left behind with those advanced and intermediate books on a much more limited availability type of level. So I think, we live in interesting times. It's going to be fun to see how things work out.
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, do you have an email address or something?
Sure. I'm going to give my private email address, which I have no problem giving out over a podcast like this, is mconlinx@yahoo.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for being on the program. Your insights, I think, will be of great benefit to people. I don't think people are aware of what's going on in the backside of the book business.
Oh, sure.
And I thought this was a great opportunity, so thanks for being on the show.
No problem. Thank you.
93.
Take care.
That about does it for today's show. Thank you for listening. The closing song is from an OTO brother named Scholar out in Las Vegas. He's done a number of rap songs about Thelema, and I'll be showcasing this one called Fight for Freedom. So thanks again for listening to the podcast. Again, please send in feedback any way you can, and also please stay tuned for the next show. Love's the law, love under will.
Thelema. Chemical fire, sulfur in my veins and blood battle ready. I stand strong, awaiting the flood. Templar, trained and initiated, duly prepared and powered on my path. I blast never ending demons to the back, get cast and sacked. Attacking like a pack of wolves, I bust back with another Gnostic track. Inflict sick, cryptic, wicked mantras and metaphors. The metamorphosis from narcissists within this chrysalis is like an arsonist. May burn away the dross, hot coals pop holes, revealing the true self within this microchasm of emptiness. The abyss. Toronto wants a bite, so I ignite and flame myself, commanding energy around me. Focus, fear not at all. Knew my refuge, had eaten my life, and so I fight. Fighters of the rights of life and liberty. Soldiers for the war, draw swords from your floorboards. Freedom to fight, freedom to organize, free to beat the freedom oppressors who keep freedom from being free. Fighters of the rights of life and liberty. Soldiers for the war, draw swords from your floorboards. Freedom to fight, freedom to organize, free to beat the freedom oppressors who keep freedom from being free. Therion, call upon the beast within me. 666 sun shone, own the solar own. My averse pentagrams vanishing weak minds. While my rhymes perplex second guessing analysts, they say you're too obscure, your thoughts lost on your audience. Are you a Satanist? What's with the beast in 666? Who are you fighting? What's the war talk?
the rights of life and liberty. Soldiers for the war, draw swords from your floorboards. Freedom to fight, freedom to organize, free to beat the freedom oppressors who keep freedom from being free. Fighters of the rights of life and liberty. Soldiers for the war, draw swords from your floorboards. Freedom to fight, freedom to organize, free to beat the freedom oppressors who keep freedom from being free. Freedom to fight, freedom to organize, free to beat the freedom oppressors who keep freedom